We can already tell that this is going to be an awesome show today.
Welcome to Mintcast, episode 313. Live stream information is at mintcast.org/livestream. We're in the Mintcast channel in IRC at irc.spotchat.org. If you see something that you'd like to hear about, tell us. Send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. Join us on MeWe, Facebook, post at the Mintcast subreddit, chat with us on Telegram, Discord, or post directly at mintcast.org. This is Leo, and with me today is Bo.
Hello, it's good to be back.
Tony Hughes.
Hi.
Moss.
Grow England.
Ooh. Oh, that's right. And Moss.
I'm still here, yeah.
Josh.
Hello.
And Joe.
Mostly here.
And we are live Sunday, July 14th, 2019. First up, in our wanderings, I do security training. Bo also trains in France. Tony goes on vacation and hugs his VPN tightly. Moss tries out Open Mandriva with more success this time. Josh replaces his PC with a new Raspberry Pi 4. And Joe reads more and considers creating a podcast. In our all-new security section, we talk about DNS over HTTPS. Then, in our news, Linux Mint is beta testing the 19.2 updates, Ubuntu considers ZFS, and Raspberry Pi successes and flaws, and more. This past couple of weeks, I have been security training. I think this is one of my favorite things to do of all time. I don't like traveling, but I do like just talking with a bunch of nerds, talking about different flaws and hacks and weird things that have gone on, for years, really. Some of these hacks are really old, like SQL injection. Those are kind of falling off in terms of popularity, but there is no shortage of people that misconfigured databases. So it's never going to go away. But the new hotness is, and I guess this has been for a couple of years, the new hotness is wide open S3 buckets, or just block storage that's been pointed out to the internet that anybody can get to that was not supposed to be configured that way. There were like hacks of the US government, and calling them hacks is not even really actually the right term, right? Because these buckets are just wide open. They're pointed out to the internet, and accidentally stumbling upon them and looking through them, I don't know.
Like,
you can argue
up to
in
somebody's
a legal sense.
Computer when they have their Facebook page open and saying you got hacked.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's like it's a hack because legally speaking, it falls under the hacking laws. But it's
illegal,
not a hack.
Access.
Yeah, it's people that don't know how to configure things or forget to lock their computer are, you know, getting taken for a ride. But anyway, so S3 buckets wide open, hilarious. And we talked a lot about just encryption and things like that. So I had a really good time at that training. And a couple of shows ago, and I'll have to find your name again, but you had suggested that we deep dive into some security topics, that would be interesting to you. That is extremely interesting to me. So we created ourselves, if you heard in the intro, an all-new security corner where I guess we can all kind of do this, but I think security is more my thing than anybody else. So I imagine it'll just be more excuse for me to talk more. But we're going to talk about DNS over HTTPS this week. And we'll see how that goes. I think everybody should do it, but I want to duke it out with anybody that doesn't want this to become mainstream. I want to chat with you about it, especially those of you sitting in the chairs across the internet from me that we'll hear from in just a sec. So anyway, security training, that was mostly what I did. Bo, you trained too. What did you train on?
Yeah, actually, it's kind of similar. It was a IPS appliance, an intrusion prevention security appliance, I can't remember what the S stands for now. Intrusion prevention system appliance.
Yeah.
But the interesting part for me was it was running on FreeBSD, so I kind of had a lot of free BSD crash coursing while I was there, and that was a lot of fun. I've never touched FreeBSD. I've listened to the Jupiter Broadcasting FreeBSD podcast like once in my entire life, and then decided I didn't know what the heck they were talking about, so I quit listening to it. I may have to pick it back up because it looks like it might be something that I'm gonna have to learn to work with. But so far it seems really cool. Most of what I wanted to bring up was just traveling to France for the training was something really cool. I got to meet a lot of my coworkers who I've been working with online. I got to meet them in person at the French office for the company I work for. And also just, you know, kind of seeing, you know, a different place and a different culture. I got to see a lot of historical places in Paris. And it was just an awesome trip. And like you, I really enjoy sort of the training process and getting to geek out with the trainer and, you know, my coworkers and things like that. So yeah, I hope they send me to more trainings and even in France, that'd be great.
So on that IPS, did it have a name, or was it, you were just building BSD?
No, it was, basically like a proprietary system for this particular manufacturing process.
Interesting. 'Cause I've trained on, Sophos equipment and Palo Alto equipment, but yeah, I don't think either of those are based off BSD. So interesting.
Yeah, those actually were mentioned a lot, so that must be the popular brands there.
Well, one of the things that Palo Alto came out with first was, so we're talking about DNS over HTTPS this week, and one of the things that Palo Alto did was they figured out how to break HTTPS, and I guess they didn't really figure out how to break it. That was already a hack. That was already something that hackers had been doing, but they figured out how to make a hack, an actual literal hack, into a feature that they charge you $1,000 for. So I'm not really a fan of these UTMs because of the stuff that they do. But then again, I mean, it's legitimizing hacking in a kind of a weird way. It's cool.
Tony, what have you been doing this week?
I helped if I put my mic on. For the last show, I was away on vacation. Just got back a week ago today. Had a great time traveling around Iceland and visiting the Giant's Causeway in Northern Ireland, which was brilliant. One of the problems I had while I was away was I couldn't access any content that was on archive.org from my mobile 4G provider. And it turns out the mobile ISP was blocking archive.org as an adult site. Don't know why, but that's what they feel it is. so it meant I couldn't download the podcast. I couldn't download any HPR shows, anything that was, using archive.org as a host. Since I got home, I was chatting with Josh last Monday, and he suggested a VPN called Proxymaster. Stuck that on my mobile, and it works like a dream. So when I'm out and about on 4G data, I can now access archive.org and any content that's stored there. So that solved that one. I've also installed Debian 10 Buster onto one of my laptops, the Toshiba Z30. That's going to be my distro for DistroHoppers OS, DistroHoppers this month. So far I'm liking it. I was listening to a bit of Big Daddy Linux Live earlier on, and they were testing out Debian, so 10 Buster, and there was various comments which I'll keep to myself for now, but I agreed with some of them and disagreed with others, but so far it's looking okay.
Oh man, I want to hear these opinions.
I'll do them on the private Discord channel because I don't want to spoil it for the listeners.
Okay.
We have a show to do, you know.
We have a show. And also, I managed to acquire Raspberry Pi 4, and I've been playing around with that. And so far, I quite like it. Got it set up here on the big TV that I've got. I had the peripherals I needed, although I did have to modify the little HDMI to micro HDMI converter I had, because the power connector and the HDMI port that is the first one to use if you're using a converter, there's not a lot of space. So I had to do a bit of on-the-go modification on that, but managed to get it so it worked. But if you're going to have two power supplies, two monitors plugged in, then you will need to get the full HDMI to micro HDMI lead, because otherwise you won't be able to plug two in, because there won't be enough space to do it. But yeah, I like it, and so far it's looking like a good piece of kit, and it's definitely getting on that way that you can use it as a day-to-day PC for light use. I've accessed Drive and typed up some of my show notes on it and things like that, so yeah, I'm quite impressed with it. But I'm going to have a play with it a lot more over the next couple of months. I might even use it as a the computer to test the what do you call it? Raspbian, and maybe do Raspbian as distro hoppers for August. So we'll see about that. But that's about it for me. Apart from watching England win the World Cup in cricket today, everything's fine with the world. So I'll hand over to Moss.
Hi, my name is Moss, and I'm a distroholic.
Hi, Moss.
Hi.
Hi, Moss.
I installed OpenMandriva LX4 with a very tiny level of success. When I set displays to use my external monitor, it freezes up. I've reported a bug to the OM4 team. I also reported a bug to the Calamaris team for one which displayed in both installs of OM4 and Farin OS, where it literally, if you're trying to use Calamaris to automatically install onto a partition that you already have in use, it does reformat that partition, but it also creates an identical imaginary partition and tries to write your distro to both. And that's a mess. Can be worked around just by going to manual partitioning, but it's supposed to work right, and it did after they fixed a little thing in OpenMandriva 3. Anyhow, I attempted to load OpenSUSE 15.1 Leap as a live disk, but it just wanted to install. I looked at the installer, and it tried to do some things I didn't want it to and offered some issues I didn't even get, so I aborted. It might be easy to install on a computer by itself, but without evaluating it a lot more, I don't recommend it. Tony Hughes and I are going experimental in this month's Distro Hoppers Digest. Instead of just encapsulating our ratings and presenting the review as such, we'll be talking our way through each step, including successes and frustrations that we took during installation. My review is on the current Farin OS version, which just got an update on July 13th. So stay tuned to Distro Hoppers Digest. We will bring you only the best. Speaking of which, after a lot of issues, some related to the Calamaris bug, I reinstalled Farin OS with a lot of help from the developer, who, as I understand it, is only a couple years older than Josh. I'm still curious as to whether it is a distinct distro, as it takes Linux Mint Cinnamon and mostly just adds a lot of theming stuff, but if it weren't distinct from Linux Mint, I would not have had so many problems getting this far. And I've been beating my head repeatedly against any available wall in using the theming in this distro, whereas a few years ago it only took a simple pair of mouse clicks to change the theme. Farin OS Next, the new version coming up, or maybe a separate version, uses Plasma 5, and I'll have to check that out. I helped a coworker who was trying to edit her resume. It looked good on her phone, but WordPad totally messed it up visually. I helped her install SoftMaker FreeOffice 2018, and everything was fine. I was amazed at how good Windows 10 has gotten at hiding essential things from users, such as how to reassign file types to programs. I got a VGA cable to attach my wife's new Hitachi 26-inch TV to her T430. The specs for the TV are amazing and the price was right, but the PC doesn't recognize it beyond 1024x768, leaving me to wonder whether her PC needs a BIOS update. I spent some time getting advice on how to fix it, but nothing has worked yet. We just bought adapters so we can use HDMI cables. Should fix the issue, arriving Wednesday.
Hey, Moss, on that one, yes? I think the issue is not your computer, it's the TV. The TV is not giving Linux the spec correctly, so it doesn't add it to the Xrander output. That's really the issue.
I'm trying the HDMI cables next.
Oh, sure. Yep, that's probably going to fix it. Because I had a monitor that was doing the same thing, and when I swapped from DVI-D to, what was it, DisplayPort? Yes. It just worked after that.
Yeah, we need to get DisplayPort adapters to go to HDMI. And they're on the way. They'll be here Wednesday. I managed to sell, or rather give away with a small exchange of money, some of my old computer equipment. I only attempted to boot one of them, and it did not turn on, but I sold that one with its killer video cards and two others, all seemingly non-working, and threw in a bunch of other stuff. So this kid plugs in the first two computers, and they booted fine, including my old Dell, which stopped booting almost 4 years ago. I would like to say I'm not crying a lot about essentially giving away hundreds of dollars of equipment just because it didn't work for me, but that would not be true. I am using the money to buy a Lenovo IdeaPad 110 with an AMD A6 chip for the price of a new Pinebook, and our listener Jackie Moore donated what I needed to get over the top without being asked. Blessings on our listeners. I still have two old computers left, the Linux box and the Hackintosh, in identical boxes, and now that I know the stuff works, I'm not going to let them go so cheaply. We received a couple support letters for my wife's immigration case, still have a lot of work to do, and my health insurance just canceled my ability to use the local health clinic and assigned me to one 24 miles away, despite the fact that there is a clinic in the same system walking distance from me. I think I'm changing insurance providers. And no matter how hard you try, you won't get me to talk about cat litter. Josh, what's up with you?
Yeah, so I have a few things to cover because I wasn't here last week. So the first thing is I recorded my first impressions video of the PyTop 4, which is a new product from PyTop. And it's on Kickstarter at the minute. It's actually, I think it took them 4 hours to get $80,000 or something like that, which was fully funded. So that was good. It's quite a cool solution, compared to the Kano starter kit, which is the same price. It's good value because in the Kano starter kit, you only get like a Raspberry Pi 2, where this is like the 4GB Raspberry Pi 4. So it's quite good value there. I've put the link in the show notes if you want to find out more about that. The audio is quite bad on the video, but I bought a new microphone to fix that for the next one. The reason I wasn't here last week is because I was in London at JP Morgan. I was nominated for the Arm Young Coder of the Year. So Arm, the computer company, chose me as their gold winner of the Young Coder of the Year, which I didn't expect, so that was quite a nice surprise. And to add to the excitement, I also won the Student of the Year, which is the overall kind of student out of everyone, which was quite nice, as it wasn't chosen by a company that is direct in the technology world like Arm is, but it was rather chosen by a bank, which was quite nice to see. And out of that, I won a Lenovo ThinkPad X1 Yoga, which is similar to the X1 Carbon, which is a laptop I've wanted for years. So that was really nice as well. On to the more exciting things. I got a new Raspberry Pi 4, the 4GB model. It took me 20 minutes after it was released to order it, because I'm slightly impatient. But anyway, it arrived the day after, which was very good. Pimeroni, who I ordered it from, are just an hour and a half away from me, so that's quite handy with delivery times. So the Raspberry Pi 4 is actually quite a nice upgrade from the last Raspberry Pi, the 3B... No. Yeah, the 3B Plus. So the Raspberry Pi 3 has been in a few different revisions. You've had the original 3, the 3B Plus, and then the 3A Plus. And now they've released the Pi 4, which was quite unexpected. So just a quick overview of what the Pi 4 looks like. You've got a new Broadcom chip, which is a 64-bit chip, so that's quite nice. It has an updated GPU, if I remember correctly. The Wi-Fi chip is the same, except it now has Bluetooth 5.0. It still has the same 40-pin header, still microSD, but there are a few changes that they've made to the bottom of the board. So you now have USB-C for power. It did originally have micro-B, which kind of makes sense to upgrade it to USB-C, because that's what everyone is using now.
We've got news about that later.
Oh, yeah. that has caused some controversial opinions this week, but I'll save that for the news later. So you got USB-C. So not only is it great because everyone has USB-C now, it's also great because you can get more power. You now have two micro HDMI instead of a full-size HDMI. So finally, you can use dual displays, which is really nice. You still got the camera and display connectors and the 3.5 headphone jack. You now have two USB 3 ports. I'm not sure why they kept the USB 2, but maybe that's just a cost-saving thing. But that's quite a nice addition. And we now finally have Gigabit Ethernet over PCIe Express rather than the really weird USB Ethernet hub thing that they had on previous models. And that's quite nice. So I decided, I had this mad idea, why not replace my lovely desktop PC, which has lots of high-performance components in, and replace it with a Raspberry Pi 4, because it has desktop performance, apparently. So that's what I did. Leo named it the Desktop Pi Challenge. I tweeted about it. So the hardware is nice. It's really fast compared to the 3B Plus. However, the software runs Debian Buster, which is now actually released, but at the time it was... the Raspbian Buster was released a few weeks before Debian was. So it was quite weird with some packages, but I think that's fixed now. The software is quite buggy. It seems half done. A lot of things aren't supported, but I think that's just a time thing. Hopefully that will change. Obviously, because the Raspberry Pi 4 is so new, it might take a while to get up to scratch with the previous models. But the thing is with the Pi 4 is you've now got 4 gigs of LPDDR4 RAM. So it's quite desktop performance-wise. It has similar specs to my phone, which is the Pixel 3. So it's more mobile performance than desktop, but it is definitely usable as a desktop PC. For entry-level users, not really high-performance users. So the RAM's nice. It makes it run really fast. So Chromium runs really fast and is really usable. LibreOffice, which is included on the operating system, is really fast and usable. I was able to use it for about 4 days until I decided that people wanted me to do some work. And when I went to install Adobe Creative Cloud, it didn't want Wine to run, so I couldn't actually run it on the Pi 4, which was a bit of a problem. So I used it about 50-50 from then on. But the dual displays allows you to get some work done, and the faster chip and RAM is really nice for using it as a desktop PC. It's definitely more usable than the Pi 3B Plus. In terms of price, I think it's quite good for... the speed, obviously, it's a desktop computer, which is for entry-level users. So $54 isn't bad for something like that. They have kept the original $35 price point for the 1GB model. I wouldn't really recommend going for that. If you want kind of like desktop performance, go for 2. But if you want the really high performance, go for 4. So the specs are more comparable to a mobile than desktop. I've already said that, but just wanted to reiterate that they are more mobile specs than desktop specs. But it's usable at the same time. The only problem is you can imagine with the heavy load and the more performance that you've got, cooling will be an issue. I think Tony touched on it before, that you kind of really do need a fan. Pimeroni did a blog post on the best cooling solutions, and it showed that using a heatsink makes about a 2-degree difference, but a fan makes a good 20-degree difference. I got a Arctic Cooling USB fan, which when I set up a little Python script to map the temperature on a graph, it dropped the temperature by about 20 degrees C, which was really nice. So do get a fan. They are quite cheap. Pimeroni have made quite a nice add-on called the fan shim, which just goes on the 40-pin header, and it goes at the bottom, and it just cools the CPU. So that does a similar job. I think I might pick one of those up. But all in all, the Pi 4, I'm really happy with it. As a desktop entry-level computer, it's definitely usable, and I think it's a step in the right direction for Raspberry Pi.
Josh,
yeah.
Have you run into the problems with the USB-C? Apparently Raspberry Pi did not follow the specs.
Yeah, so for me, I think this might be quite controversial. I think people just need to not worry about it too much. I think obviously the media can get quite involved with this sort of stuff. But it's not really much of an issue because it's only a very small minority of USB chargers. The problem is that you've got these like smart USB chargers. I think they're called USB-C E chargers or something like that. And they're detecting the Raspberry Pi as an audio peripheral rather than a device to charge. So I've not actually run into the issue yet, but I know some people have. So I'm yet to replicate that. But hopefully they'll fix that on a later design.
Yeah, the chargers are really just ones that like ship with laptops because the laptops will have to negotiate how much power they want and all that kind of fun stuff. And the Raspberry Pi doesn't give enough information to really negotiate that. So it just fails down to nothing. But we'll have some more specs on that. But I had a comment and a question. So my question is, so on dual display, so on a single display, Raspberry Pi will give you a 1080p at 60 frames or 60 hertz. When you go to dual display, it goes to 1080p at 30 hertz. Can you feel that? Like, I mean, it's just one of those things you have to like really pay attention to see. But did you notice it?
So it's actually not 1080p. It's 4K that happens.
Oh, okay. So I read that wrong.
So the what happens is because there's timing issues, you have one display at 60 hertz 4K. And then another display at 4K 30. 1080p, as far as I can see on mine, it runs them both at 60. But I think they will, once they get some of those timings fine-tuned, I think they are planning to make them both run at 60. But I imagine you could notice a difference. But on mine, they were both the same because I'm only running 1080p.
I'll come in here, Josh. Yeah. When I was running the Raspberry Pi on Saturday at the jam, I was playing a video on YouTube, and I'd also downloaded a video and I was playing it locally, and it was struggling to play two videos on the machine natively. And that was at less than 1080p. So I've got doubts whether it can run two 4K monitors.
Well, a lot of that
Have you actually had it running on two 4K monitors?
I've not actually had it running on two 4K monitors, but I think the issue is that the new one uses, don't quote me on this, but I think the problem is that it's running, the new Pi 4 is using H.265 encoding, and the YouTube's playing H.264. Because it got a browser extension on Chromium. So I think that's why YouTube videos on their own, when nothing else is open, are really bad on the Raspberry Pi 4. I think that's just a browser issue. But I think we have to kind of realize that it is only still a low power, low spec computer. Hopefully, I know some people have had video playing better than you described, but I'm not sure how they did that. I'll have to look into it.
Okay, my other thing is, I want to know how winning two national awards and a £1,600 laptop is less exciting than the Pi 4.
Well, yeah, so that was kind of, it was kind of really unexpected to do that. I went in thinking, oh, I was going to win nothing, because they... at the award ceremony, they actually flashed up an image of me by mistake. And I thought, oh, well, they'll announce bronze, silver and gold in order. So I was going in fully expecting, oh, I've won bronze. But no, I ended up winning a £1,600 laptop, which is more than what I thought I was getting, because the model that they said I was originally getting, they seemed to upgrade it. I'm quite excited for that, because I've never actually really had a new laptop. I've only ever bought secondhand. Hopefully next week, I'll have something to report back on, hopefully.
Well, congratulations, cool. Man.
Brilliant. Yeah, congratulations. I had one last comment on the cooling needed thing on the Pi. It's not just that you need cooling, it's that the Pi will actually throttle once it hits like 72C or whatever the upper threshold is.
Oh, yeah, I had...
It will scale back.
Oh. Yeah, I had it sitting at 68 degrees idle just on a Chrome tab without cooling.
Wow.
So they did originally have some issues where they had to release a new firmware because it was something to do with the USB 3 was... overheating or something like that, and that's
the USB 3 controller. Yeah, it was overheating everything else.
You did say it was 64-bit. Will it run full modern Chrome?
So this is the interesting thing. So the operating system Raspbian is only running at 32-bit for some reason. They haven't released a 64-bit version of it.
That's to make it backwardly compatible with the previous versions.
I think really what they should do is just release a separate image for the Pi 4 if they want to keep that backwards compatibility. Because you're kind of having all these devices out there now with the Pi 4 that aren't being used to the full potential. I think that's a shame.
I think that's probably going to come in the future, but I think they wanted to just get an image out that was suitable for all the Pis, but because it's a big piece of work to create a new image.
The 3B Plus was 64-bit, if I remember. But yeah, hopefully they'll work on that. But no, it just runs the standard Chromium at the minute.
Yeah.
Do y'all see what happens when we let someone talk about a Pi? It just turns into a Pi show.
It does. Just to say, I've stuck a link in my comments to the fan shim. So there's a link in the notes for that as well.
Cool. Check that out because it seems quite nice. I haven't got one yet, but hope to soon.
All right. And Joe, what do you got for us? You've been reading?
Yeah. Well, I say reading. Mostly it's, listening. So all of these are in audio. I was rereading the Dragon Knight series, which I read as a kid, and the last book came out in, I think, 2000. It's by Gordon R. Dixon, and the audiobook is very well done. I highly recommend the series, and I really enjoyed going back and listening to it all again. And that's 9 books total. So if you're looking for a slightly longer series, that's one that I would recommend. And I also gave The Amber Cycle a try by Roger Zelazny. And this is, well, according to Moss, this is his most commercially successful series. And I cannot recommend these audiobooks. The audio quality is very bad. It was recorded in the 90s by the author. And you can, even on the digital version, you're getting that tape hiss. And I listened to everything at like 3x. And I turned the speed down on this to like 2.4, 2.5. And maybe it's just a bit too convoluted as well. The books are fairly short. I think they're 6 hours total, which means I'm doing them usually in 2.5 to 2 hours. But it's just not been an enjoyable read. And I'm going to have to find hard copies and give that another try and see if it comes off better.
Find some other books by Zelazny. He's a wonderful writer, just not in amber.
Yeah. Yeah, I will definitely look at some of his other works and see how good they are. But hopefully a bit more audio production would be nice. And I'm thinking about starting a section either on this show or spinning off another podcast for just audio listening in general. Audiobooks, audio dramas, podcasts, and that I would recommend for others. But I'm not sure if I want to do that. I know a lot of other people have given it a try, and it rarely makes it past like 10 or 15 episodes just because, you know, eventually you stop listening for a little while, or you want to go through your old classics again, but you don't want to, you know, rehash that in a podcast format. So it would be extremely difficult to keep up for any amount of time, but it's something I've been bouncing around in my head for a really long time now. Maybe just also include reviews for different headsets.
Yeah, that's one of those things that, like, if you, I don't know, whatever you like doing, it once you turn it into a job, it's just one of those things you have to consider how it's going to affect you, and especially if it's, like, a time commitment, like 2 hours for one book that you would review over a podcast or something like that. You've got to find time to do that, and then when you have to put other things off to force yourself to enjoy something so you can review it right is, I don't know, it's just a huge commitment. So one of those things that's just hard to do.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't know about the return on investment on that. Just the, you know, the time basis. Would I actually get anything out of it? But or would anybody else get anything out of it? I don't know. Maybe I'll give it a try and just see what happens. Also, me and my wife are looking for new cell phones, probably. I mean, we're still running the Galaxy S7, and it's getting old. The batteries aren't lasting as long as they used to. My 3.5 millimeter jack has gone out. The wife has already had a replacement phone on insurance because, well, no, on warranty on that one, because she had severe screen burn-in. And so we're debating what phones we would like to get. We were looking at the S10s because I think you can still get them, buy one, get another $900 off, but it's still an insane amount to pay for a phone. And I have been looking at the OnePlus line to see if we might be interested in anything there, but it's a tough call. Or we could wait for the new Note and see what happens there, but that's going to be even more expensive than the S10s. And a lot of the rumors say that they're not going to have a 3.5 millimeter jack at all, and I really like having a 3.5 millimeter jack. And Moss, you were saying something about the X4?
I'm saying X4s... Moto has decided not to make an X5. You can get a refurbished or a new X4 for as cheap as $120, and it's almost a flagship level phone.
Cool. Well, I've also heard good things about the Pixel 3a.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's all stuff that I'm definitely going to look into. I mean, the only reason I really want the S10 is because of the DeX capability, the actual ability to have a Linux operating system just by hooking up a monitor and keyboard. But I still don't think it's worth that price for that feature. And I don't know if I can get it anywhere else. If there's a large expansion in the future on something like Maru OS, then I'd be good to go.
Yeah,
go ahead, Josh.
The the 3A, Android Q, the new version of Android, is going to have a desktop environment. Apparently, that's one of the features in the beta right now. So the 3A will eventually have that.
Yeah, a buddy of mine has that phone, and it's a pretty solid phone to be priced at what it's priced at. I got to play with a OnePlus while I was in France. One of my coworkers at the French office had a OnePlus. I think it was the OnePlus 6, maybe. I don't know. I'm not up on their numbering. But it was a solid phone. I mean, I've used Samsungs for the past, you know, several years, and the OnePlus felt pretty smooth, felt pretty nice.
Okay, yeah. Well, I haven't been hands-on with a OnePlus at all, which was one of the reasons that, you know, I'm not jumping on it. And the price has been climbing over the years. I've kept an eye on that. But it's also because they've added functionality. So you can't complain too much about that. But moving on from cell phone woes, I have been also with the wife enjoying the new Swamp Thing from DC Streaming. It's doing really well as a horror show, and all of DC Streaming shows so far I have greatly enjoyed. So if you're thinking about adding one more streaming service, I recommend that one. They also have a fairly good backlog of movies and DC TV shows.
I didn't realize the Swamp Thing show was out yet. I was just watching a teaser for that in anticipation. So I'm missing out.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, they're doing weekly releases instead of, you know, making it so you can binge it all at once right away.
Yeah. I prefer the weekly release.
Yeah, it's every Thursday right now.
Man, I'm going to have to get you to come on the next ECN Radio so we can talk about Swamp Thing.
Okay. Well, if you get a chance to watch it. I will definitely discuss it with you.
I will do it.
Okay. Oh, and I picked up some new tech. Nothing overly exciting, but I picked up an Echo Input, which is, you know, the Amazon's new Echo device. And it's interesting. I mean, you hook up your own speaker to it instead of it having a built-in speaker, which means that, you know, if you have a high-quality Bluetooth speaker or aux speaker sitting around, you can hook it up to there, and it'll sound great. I got it on sale. I believe even now it's on sale for $15. And I do have a question for you guys in just a second, but I will get to that because I also picked up two Smart Life bulb sockets, which are Amazon compatible. Yes, and I'm refusing to use the other word as much as possible unless I slip. Amazon compatible bulb sockets. So you screw that into your light socket, and then you screw a bulb into it, and it works like any other Wi-Fi connected device. Just got them before the show. Just got the one set up and ready to go. I still got to set up the other one. It was a bit of a pain to set up, but now that it is, it's working great. I'll let you know if it dies in the next couple of weeks or anything like that, but I'm going to have it set up on a timer out in the garage, and because, you know, I have a lot of electronics equipment out there, and have the lights controlled that way and turn off automatically as soon as I leave for work, and just see if I can reduce the amount of electricity I use during the summer, because I don't know about anybody else, but the electrical costs are insane in the Dallas area.
Texas is hot.
Yeah. Well, when you're using air conditioning that much, I guess it would be. But, you know, between $300 and $400 a month for electricity.
Well, I find that it costs me less to air condition my house during the summer than to heat it during the winter. About half.
Well, what type of heating do you have?
A heat pump.
Gas?
Nope, it's all electric.
Yeah.
The heat pump, air conditioner, heat, same thing.
Yeah, it's actually cheaper, at least for us, to do gas for heating in the winter.
Too.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I would tell you to talk to your little device and say hello to your NSA handler for me.
Whatever.
Yeah.
They can't catch me typing. That's all I'm going to say.
And, yeah, my my tinfoil hat shimmers every time any of those things kind of come up.
Right.
We've unplugged both of ours.
And, well, I have one in my bedroom as well to control the lights in there. But I think I'm also going to hook up another smart socket out in the garage and just have that turn off and on my monitors, my two giant monitors out there. And that should save me quite a bit of electricity if those are shut off just while I'm at work. And I'm thinking the input's not actually going to go there. I'm going to swap the input out for one of the dots that I have, the one in the bedroom. And my wife had an idea for a project, and we have an old clock, and she wants me to take out the face of that and put the input in that hole. I'll have to do some cutting and some reconfiguring because the hole's actually bigger. So I'm going to have to get a piece of wood and make two holes in it and set it up there. And probably put the Bluetooth speaker inside the clock. And just, it will be helpful because we currently have the dot set up on one side of the bedroom, and sometimes it doesn't hear me, but if we put it in the clock face, then we're going to hang it up over the top of the bed, and it should be able to hear us both better then. And that's all I have.
Cool. I had a couple of comments. So to finish off...
My question. I almost forgot my question. Are you guys planning on getting anything or have any plans for Prime Day, which is, you know, tomorrow as of the time of this recording?
I do. I want to get a water cooling, all-in-one water cooling cooler, if they come down. I found a nice NZXT one because my CPU cooler is really loud, and I'm hoping to sort that out by picking up a deal tomorrow. But that's all I'm looking for.
I was
going to
suggest the NZXT. I switched from a Coolants to NZXT, and Coolants at the time was the more expensive product, but the NZXT actually has performed better.
I support the Amazon workers' strike and will not participate.
I also mention it because, you know, like the first year, Prime Day was really good and there were some really awesome deals there and plenty of stuff that everybody wanted to buy. But since that first year, I mostly haven't seen anything worth jumping on for Prime Day. I think I bought one item last year.
At the risk of sounding, getting too off into the weeds, really, I feel like that's Amazon's MO though, isn't it? They entice you in with the cheap prices and then they jack them up so that you don't realize that you're paying an extra 50 cents for everything.
Jeff Bezos wants to save all his money for his space program.
Hey, man, he's got to get to Mars, okay?
Him and Elon are in a race.
Yeah. But to finish off the idea that I had on the phone thing that I was talking about, me and my wife kind of do it in a weird way. So I'm more of a PC guy, and she's more of a mobile gal. So I'll allow her – I mean allow. Yeah, like she'll go out and get whatever she wants on the phone side. And then when she's done with it, when she's ready for a new one, I'll inherit whatever she had, and then she'll get the new stuff. And then I'm the same with the PC because she does a lot of desktop stuff. So – I'll go out and buy the coolest stuff that I can get my hands on PC-wise, you know, within reason, I guess. And like I have a Ryzen 1700 now, and that's what she'll inherit soon because the Ryzen 3700 is out. I'm so excited.
we tend to do the buy one, get ones from Samsung, which is, so we get phones at the same time, but, you know, it's usually a really good deal. But in this case, because I would want, you know, probably the S10 Plus because I'm me. And that's like a $1,600 phone and no.
Yeah, it's too
yeah
much.
Really. Yeah, and I mean, the math kind of works out that way, though, like if we were to have done the buy one, get one or whatever, because I don't really actually have any reason to upgrade my phone other than my wife's done with it, so she's given it to me so we can, you know, sell the bottom of the barrel one, and then I can, we can all move up one. So money wise, I think it all kind of shakes out just fine. But yeah, I don't get the newest of the new on the mobile side.
We almost never sell our old phones. They all get handed down one more person.
What's funny about that is I'm doing that now. So my daughter, who is like 3, who has no idea about any of this stuff, unless I can find some other use for it, is going to inherit a Intel Xeon 1230 V2 and a Radeon R something 270, something like that. So like she'll be able to play Fortnite crazy, but you know, not like she can actually play Fortnite.
Yeah. Well, my daughters also have a tendency to break phones. So currently my middle child has my old Note 3 and my eldest had my S3, but no longer. I'm not even, I think she's got the wife's old Samsung Galaxy Avant. So yeah, we make phones last a really long time. So sometimes it is worth that investment.
Yeah, it really is, because I mean, you spend that much money, and as long as it lasts you for like 6 to 8 years, I mean, that's a pretty decent investment.
Yeah. Well, we've had the S7s now since like release day, so 3+ years. Can't complain too much about that on a flagship.
Yeah, for sure.
And that is the last of what I have.
All right, so we'll head on to the news. So in this Fortnite's news, we have a lot of stuff, actually. First up, we have the Linux Mint June's monthly news. And every month, Clem comes out and lets us know the state of the union. And the union is strong, or something like that, right? So we got quite a few things. Have you guys taken a look at any of the new stuff that's coming down?
Nope.
You're just here for the surprise, huh?
Yeah, I like surprises.
Well, let me surprise you. So the last show, we talked about Joey from OMG Ubuntu talking about how it's going to be just kind of a mundane release. And I mean, not mundane, I guess, really in a bad way, but I kind of read it that way. Maybe that was just me. But anyway, it's not. It is not a mundane release at all. It's not just bug fixes at all. So let's dive in. So the first set of stuff that that Clem's talking about is the idea of pinning an item in a folder. And so this is one of those things that's going to be Cinnamon only. I don't know if Matei is going to get it. I don't know if XFCE is going to get it. But you know, I had mentioned last show, this is why you want to use Cinnamon. I had a reason for that. And then, so here's reason number 2. You can pin items in Nemo. And what this means is that when you open a folder that has 6 gajillion files in it, and the file that you want starts with a P, you gotta scroll, you know, 60% of the way down that entire folder, or do searching, or whatever. What if you could just pin it to the top of that folder? Well, now you can. That's the idea. You just pin it to the top. Easy peasy. And then that file or that folder will be at the top, regardless of what letter it starts with, or if it starts with a number or whatever. It will just be at the top. So if you use it all the time,
what if pin it. You didn't file your files by alpha? You have other ways to organize your files.
Exactly. This is totally it, right? I mean, it doesn't matter how you deal with your file name. Just pin it. Pin it.
This is like the modern version of putting an underscore at the beginning of the folder name. Like this
Oh my God, right?
Yeah. It's so that you can pin it to the top as you would, you know, similar to like social media. You can pin, you know, a particular blog post if it's so relevant that, you know, people that visit your site may need to see it more often than they see the previous blog posts. So it's similar to that, something you use frequently. Yeah,
exactly.
I and like it. I dig it.
Good. Me too. I'm see, this is why I love using Cinnamon, man. And I even make a mention of it later on, that this is one of the big reasons I love sticking on Cinnamon.
If it ends up really useful, it'll end up on, you know, all the desktops.
Watch. I guarantee it. I guarantee it. Hmm. So if you're using the terminal, yeah, you're still going to have to stick an underscore at the front of those things. But in Nemo, pinned up at the top, nice. Then we have this other thing. And oh, wow. So this is something that you can actually do in Windows already. Sort of. You can make those context menus. So when you right-click on a file, there is a... Like if you right-click on a JPEG or whatever, Clem had mentioned inside of there that you can set as wallpaper. What if you could make it do anything that you wanted to with a script? So any script that you have already created that is, say I wanted to, and another one of the things that Clem had mentioned was convert audio from DTS to AC3. What if you could just right click on an audio file and click that and then out pops an AC3 file or a video or anything? What if you wanted to convert JPEG to PNG? What if you wanted to convert PNG to TIFF or any of that kind of stuff? If you can script it, you can create what he's calling a conditional menu that will allow you to just, yeah, right-click on a file and make it go. No popping That's open awesome. A terminal, no running a script. Yes, this is, oh my gosh, man. So there's just a lot of times where I have to dump down into a terminal and do stuff when I'm just like, ugh, it could be easier. He's done it. He's made it easier. So by the way, all this stuff is coming in 19.2. So it's not here yet, but we're beta testing now. So if you're brave enough, you can open up that beta channel and get some of this. So the next thing is the cinnamon menu will now make it apparent what version of the generally named apps you're running. So what this means is, so let's say you go out and you install Gedit, and then you install Gedit through Flatpak. So when you open up the menu, it doesn't actually tell you which is which. It just says Gedit on both. Well, I guess it's kind of a bad example because Gedit would show up as text editor, but it works for that as well. So let's say you had two text editors, Gedit and Zed, and in the Mint menu, it just shows up as two text editors. And so it's like a roulette wheel, which one you're going to get. Well, now the text editor actually says in parentheses over to the right, Gedit and Zed. So you know exactly which one you're getting when you click on it. But further than that, if you install Gedit on Flatpak, it would also show you the Flatpak version of the app that you're using. So there's no more confusion in the menu as to which one you're going to click on. So this is just a nice little quality of life addition that kind of made my life kind of weird because I like to install a bunch of different software.
I could see another use case, like if, say, for example, you play Final Fantasy XIV, as I'm sure nobody on this podcast spends too much time doing that. If you install it using Steam and you also install it using Lutris and then you respectively use both to create a menu item, it's hard to distinguish which one is which, but this giving you a more qualified name, yeah, would be really helpful.
Yep. It just saves you pain and I love it. So another cool little quality of life thing is the scroll bar settings. So in the right-hand side of every cinnamon window, you have a scroll bar. Well, now you can hide it. Easy, right? Nothing too exciting, but I don't know. If you like having those clean, no muss, no fuss, like outside areas, right? You just want it to be nothing but clean. This is just a way to do that. And Mintbox 3, this is something that we had kind of hinted at on the last show. They're going to be beefy. There's going to be a price to match that, but these things are going to be utter powerhouses of devices. So here, give me just one sec, and I can tell you exactly what kind of specs. But I know that the lesser expensive one is going to have a 6-core i5 in it, 16 gigs of RAM, a 256 gig SSD, Wi-Fi, and a bunch of front facing ports. The expensive one is going to be come with an i9. I think that's the Ocho core, the Octo core, whatever it is. I don't quote me on that. It doesn't say, so I'm not positive. But also ships with a GTX 1660 Ti, 32 gigs of RAM, a terabyte SSD, Wi-Fi, and that same front-facing modules. If you go look at the picture, you'll see what I'm talking about that front-facing thing. Everything is just right there. And these boxes are tiny. So, well, tiny is as tiny as you can get a huge powerhouse of a machine. So just really, really nice. And if you haven't realized yet, pretty much people will just pile on to things that Clem says So Clem has a section right down here that's talking about snaps that I have this feeling that people are going to pile on, if they haven't already. And it's really just Clem's ideas on where Snap is going. And I got to say, I agree with him to a point. So let's kind of get into the weeds of what he's talking about. So he says that he's worried about Snap cornering the market. And that in and of itself isn't a bad thing because options, right? Like you have options. But he uses the example of Spotify. Imagine a world where you are Fedora. You run Fedora all day, every day. How do you install Spotify? And there is no way for you to install Spotify using just the stuff that Fedora gives you, as far as I know. So please correct me if I'm wrong. But there's no RPM, right? You probably have to go in and add some kind of crazy third-party repository to make it work. So on the Ubuntu side, you can install the Deb. And this allows you to sidestep pretty much any kind of Snap anything. But he kind of posits a question. What happens if Spotify stops rolling a Deb? Then your only option is Snap. And it is their prerogative. They can do what they want. And but where does that leave the Fedora users, right? They have to install Snapd. You do not get a choice that's kind of the situation they're in right now. You don't really get a choice on how to install Spotify officially. I'm sure there are third-party ways to do it, but officially. So he kind of takes this onto the next step, because this is not hypothetical. The Spotify thing was hypothetical. This is not hypothetical. Ubuntu is considering putting Chromium as a Snap-only installer. So what this means is you'll still be able to apt-install Chromium, but that will change from installing it from your typical apt repository to installing it, or it's turning into basically just a pointer to Snap. So when you apt-install Chromium, and you know, just imagine if you will, if you do this in Mint, apt-install Chromium, it will only be available to you in Snapd. So in Linux Mint, we don't get Snapd by default. I install it because I'm not too worried about it, but the idea that it will install Snap behind your back, that might be the way that they implement this. Because in Ubuntu, right, Snap is already installed. What is going to happen when Snap is not installed? Does it come back and tell you that, oh, now you have to install Snap? Or does it just install Snap for you? I don't know. I would suspect that it would just install Snap for you, because, I mean, they're trying to make it easy, right? It's just one of those things that you lose out on choice. And then he posits the next question. What happens if to install a Snap, you have to have an Ubuntu One account? Now, this is hypothetical again, but what happens if they wall garden it? Where are we at in a free kind of way? Where are we? Do y'all have any comments or anything about those things?
Snap's open source at the moment, isn't it?
Right. And the thing that he's getting at is that it'll still be open source, but what if they put an Ubuntu One account before you can install Snaps?
But what I'm saying is, if it's open source, so surely another distro could take it and recompile it as their own version of what would be a Snap and set it up that everyone can use it, other than, you know, if the Ubuntu community want to wall garden the official Snaps, they could, in the same way as Firefox, these different versions of Firefox using the same code, but they just don't call them Firefox.
True.
Surely you could do that with Snaps.
But I imagine I guess if you're really buzzed about security, then you will go out and seek this kind of thing out. But what does it mean for regular users? And do they even care?
I'm not sure.
Right. And to be honest with you, I don't think they care. I really don't think that someone that installed Linux Mint because they're tired of Windows, I don't think they care. But
that's probably true.
Yeah. But for people like me, and obviously people like Clem, we care. I kind of don't want random stuff on my machine that I didn't say that I wanted on my machine in a roundabout kind of way, you know?
What I would suspect is that it would warn you that it was going to install these additional things with just a Y or an N for yes or no. And most people would not even read it and just hit Y.
Yeah, and that kind of feeds into the whole, do they even care? And you know, if you don't care enough to read what's happening on your system, then you don't. And you know, not in a bad way, right? Not necessarily. I'm not picking at you. I'm just saying that I don't think you care enough, which is, that's fine. You can care as much as you want to care. But I guess, I don't know. I'm a weirdo. I like to read all those messages. I like to know what's going on. And so I would probably hit no. My tinfoil hat will shine a little bit more, and I'll say, maybe not. Thankfully, there's still a deb for Spotify, but, you know, Chromium may not be that way. And I do have Chromium installed on my machine. So actually, that brings up a good point. What happens to me on my Linux Mint machines that have Chromium installed after this
switch? You quit getting updates.
Do you think Ubuntu would allow that?
Yeah. If you want the next version, you have to install the snap version, so you just quit receiving updates.
Right. Yeah. Does it come up with a message and say, hey, the way that Chromium is installed is changing. Do you want to accept snapd being installed on your machine? Does that happen?
Don't know.
Yeah. So my issue is not really with it happening. It's how they're going to present it and how they're going to force you or not to do it. But
coming back to the tinfoil hat approach, though, surely this kind of relates to the issue with IBM and Red Hat and the Fedora community. When IBM took over Red Hat, there was a lot of worry that Fedora was going to suddenly either disappear or, you know, become something that the Fedora community were, you know, they were going to have problems with, because IBM might think, well, it's not economic for us to create something that we're not making any money out of. And surely this is the same with Snapd. Surely it's... What would the mileage be with Canonical saying, you know, Snapd suddenly going to become this thing that's behind a walled garden? Because a lot of the development is still community development, and then they're cutting their own throat, aren't they?
I suspect you're right, actually. I don't think they would do this, but it's just a question that Clem posited, and I figured we'd take it there. But yeah, I really agree
with
you on
that one.
Think
of all those people using Dev1 that will not be able to use Chromium anymore.
Right, and that goes on. I imagine Clem installed Flatpak natively in Linux Mint for the same reason that we have LMDE, right? Just as a... not really where I want things to go overall, so let's just go this way with it. So yeah, more of an escape hatch or something like that. Yeah. Definitely. So we'll kind of see where this goes. I don't think Ubuntu 1 is going to do whatever Ubuntu 1 is going to do, or you know, putting it in front of Snap or anything like that. But it does make me wonder about apps like Spotify. If they ever drop Deb, you know, how's that going to work? How are you going to get it? And will it be official or whatnot? So we'll just have to wait and see about all of that.
Is Ubuntu 1 still a thing? I thought Canonical had killed Ubuntu 1 anyway.
Well, I think it was more of a... I think you're right. But I think it's more of a... If Ubuntu decides to do a walled garden approach, you know, they might resurrect it and use it for something like that. But I don't know. I'll have to look into the Ubuntu 1 thing, whether or not it still really exists or not.
Okay.
So the last couple of things on this was that Linux Mint 20, there will be no 32-bit version. Oh, no! Does that affect anybody here?
Nope.
Yeah. No. So we're all on 64-bit, I think. You've got to be a pretty staunch holdout to still be installing 32-bit versions of anything. But nobody forgot about you, because Linux Mint 19 is going to be supported until 2023. And in my opinion, it was inevitable. It's a lot of work to put a 32-bit version of an entire operating system out there. And I really feel like this is something that the Mint crew had to do to really refocus their efforts on where Linux Mint is gonna be rather than where Linux Mint was or the holdouts, right? So I think this is a good thing. Do you guys think about the 32-bit drop?
It is inevitable. I mean, you're always going to have people that are going to complain about that as well, because they are using older hardware and only can use a 32-bit system. I know that there's still a couple of older tablets that I have that will only load a 32-bit version, but eventually I'm just going to have to use whatever is still available or find an old version. So,
Debian!
Yeah.
But I thought everyone was still using 16-bit Windows.
Well, I mean, not on purpose.
I've got to say, even if you're using 10-year-old hardware, most of it supports the 64-bit these days.
Right.
AMD introduced single-core 64-bit before Intel introduced the 64-bit dual-core.
Oh, the Athlon.
So,
Still have a couple of devices that have 64-bit processors but use 32-bit UEFIs, but that's easier and easier to get around all the time.
Yeah, I think...
I think the big issue is going to be on ARM with 32-bit and 64-bit ARM. But even that's starting to become less of an issue.
Yeah, really, really. But I think it's a separate thing, the 32-bit 64 over there. It's a totally separate thing. But yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just one of those things that it's time. It's time. All right. So let me see. Oh, man. I keep getting knocked out of my show notes.
Pick up the slack, Leo.
I know. Speaking of slack, nice segue. So the last thing that we have on this list that Clem let us know was that there is a Slack channel for media. We kind of mentioned this the last time that we were in it. And so if you're part of the media, if you report on anything, go join that Slack, because this is going to be a horse's mouth kind of thing. So you don't get the weird opinionated stuff. But here's my opinion. Hopefully, this will combat some of those clickbait articles, but if it generates money, they're still going to make them. So I really don't think it's gonna change anything overall, but it'll be an easy way for people to be like, nah, that's BS. Look at what he really said. As opposed to just having a blog post or something like that. You can actually have real conversation and really get to the root of, you know, especially if Clem types something that might be seen as controversial, you can clarify. It's not another 30 days before you figure out what was really meant or something like that. So overall, it's good, but I'm cynical. I don't think it's going to help the clickbait articles much.
Yeah, you don't see a whole lot going on in that Slack right now. Hopefully, it starts picking up a bit more.
But are there a lot of pointed questions toward Clem on that?
There isn't much right now. Matter of fact, I can still see the post from a couple of weeks ago about the about our podcast. So I'm really hoping that it does pick up. I'm interested in things that could be happening there. But we'll see.
That just sounds like to me.
And it gives us another place to advertise our podcast.
Well, true. But I think overall, that just sounds to me like we just need to go poke the bear.
Probably.
Yeah, let's go poke the bear.
Well, have you signed up yet? I see Rob in there. I see Moss and myself.
I will get in there this week. There was a link, right?
Yeah. It went to...
It's in your Mintcast email.
Yeah.
Ooh, okay. I'm going to go click that later. That's awesome. I will go join because I want to poke the bear too. All right. Next up in our news, Ubuntu rolling out experimental ZFS in 19.10. So who uses ZFS?
Right now, nobody running Ubuntu.
I think we've just pissed off everybody that uses FreeNAS. They're like, yeah, I use ZFS.
Okay, and I know BSD Now got mentioned earlier in the podcast. I'm going to bring it up again because I actually do listen to them, and they talk a lot about ZFS and setting up ZFS and upcoming changes to ZFS. So if you're interested, go back and listen to some of their old episodes in regards to ZFS.
Yeah, it's totally worth the listen. Does Alan Jude still do that show?
I think so.
Yeah, man, he's sharp. I like him. And then...
Yeah, we have to leave it to our Canadians to do the good stuff.
Yeah, that's all right. Well, so the idea with this ZFS thing was that there was a proposal in Ubuntu that they add ZFS as an option during install. So we'll have to wait and see if it comes out in 19.10 or not. And I mean, I'll certainly be playing with it because, I mean, right. Great. I think it's just the more options we have, the better.
Yeah, I've installed ZFS before, and I think I've set up like one pool, but, you know, the amount of hard drives I'm running, it's not really worth it to have a ZFS set up. If I were running like a high-end server or something, then that would be a different story, but yeah, my use case doesn't include ZFS.
ZFS really protects against things like bit rot and just... errors on disk. So, I mean, if you're not really worried about that kind of thing, I don't think ZFS is going to be any better than anything else. And in my use case, I can't afford the disks to, well, the RAM too. Yeah. Cause you got to have like 1 gig per terabyte of storage and I can't afford that. So, my solution was to buy good NAS hard drives and back them up to crappy USB Seagate pieces of trash. But I still have a backup and I can still recover in case something goes wrong. But yeah, I don't know. There's only a small bit of data that I have that I can't lose. And that's backed up in 3 places. In my security classes, I always mention that backups equals backups minus 1. That's how many backups you have. So if you have 2 backups... I'm sorry, what is it? Something like data equals backups minus 1 or something like that. So if you only have 1 backup, you have 0 backups. Because it's when something goes wrong, what is it? Is it Moore's Law, the one where something will go wrong? It'll always go wrong? Yeah, it'll always go wrong.
No, Moore's Law is about the changing over time of chips, the doubling of speeds. You're thinking Murphy's Law.
Yeah, Murphy's Law. So yeah, because
anything
it'll always
can
go wrong.
Wrong will go wrong.
Uh-huh. And that's just from working and seeing it actually happen in front of my eyeballs. And I'm like,
Murphy
was
an optimist.
Yeah. Why does this tape not work? And yeah, anyway, so that was not fun. So yeah, backups equals backups minus 1. And then RISC-V gets a dedicated graphics dev. So RISC-V
Keith Packard.
Cool. So it's moving forward. Moss, do you know much about that?
Yeah, Keith Packard joined the RISC-V company Sci-5. This is Keith Packard. He was the longest still active ex-Windows system developer. He worked on the open source Linux graphics driver stack before working for HP Labs and also had a side gig for Valve improving the Linux stack for VR. And he announced on July 1st on his blog that he's now working full-time at Sci-5. He's going to be working on RISC-V based processors and other tasks while he's parting ways with HP Labs.
Very cool. Well, we've already talked about the Raspberry Pi 4 thing, but just to reiterate, they tried to do something clever. They tried to add one resistor where 2 was required. And the one really piece of thing that I wanted to get out there was that it's really not that big of a deal if you're buying the Raspberry Pi USB-C charger or whatever. But yeah, it'll fail down if you use some of the more expensive ones. But here's the deal. If the Raspberry Pi hardware devs would have gone exactly to the USB spec, this would not have happened. So I don't think it was anything malicious, but oversight that just kind of cost them. So it's going to take a new board revision. This is not a firmware update fix. So you'll need a new Raspberry Pi 4 if you want to actually fix this. But I think like Josh said, it's not really going to affect many people. It's if you're just trying to slap any old USB-C thing, you might run into this.
Yeah, like it costs $7 for the official USB-C lead. So really, it's right? Not that much if you need to buy one.
Yeah, I went ahead and bought one. It was 10 for me, but I guess that's the difference between pounds and dollars. But yeah, it was 10 bucks for me and I just have it. And I don't ever have to worry about this. So if I buy one and I get the old revision, I don't care. It's fine. It'll work. And then, let me see. OpenSUSE plans name change. Starts a foundation. Uh-oh. So, is this a good thing or what?
Oh, I guess that's me.
You keep dumping them in there.
Well, I can't help it. It's one of those compulsion type things. The OpenSUSE project is going on, but SUSE is getting more commercial, and OpenSUSE is deciding that they just have too much going on to get donations on their own, so they're starting a foundation, and to start the foundation without having complete control by SUSE, which is now owned by a venture capitalist company, they kind of got the idea that it might be time for a new name. There's still quite a bit of talking going both ways, and it's all being very pleasant at this point. There is no consensus.
Did we lose him or did we lose me?
Oh, man, I thought it was me.
I'm here.
I'm
not here.
Oh, we couldn't hear you for a bit there. You cut out in the mid-sentence.
How come I keep cutting out?
You have you got my bug from last show.
Yeah, well, anyhow, they've been talking about it in very non-controversial tones. There is no consensus, and they are also talking about changing the logo.
I like that little lizard. I don't want them to change that. All right, well, we'll kind of see where that one goes, but one great thing that affects Linux Mint is Ubuntu offers latest NVIDIA drivers to LTS users. So that means that you'll get the latest NVIDIA drivers on install. It'll stay up to date, and anybody installing Linux Mint also benefits from this. So if you're on Team Green, tisk tisk, then this means that you'll not have to do any kind of weird PPA, any kind of weird script. It just works. I love it when
it's not open source.
It just works.
If you're using Team Green, you don't care about open source. You never cared about open source because Nuvo sucks.
Yes.
Nonetheless, a lot of people have been commenting on how much love is being given to NVIDIA for all this from all these various Linux companies, whereas AMD has been open source this whole time, and they sort of get pushed off to the side.
Yeah, they shouldn't get pushed off to the side. AMD should be what you're buying, especially
now,
if you've just taken listen.
If you want to have this argument of like the last 10 years of graphics cards.
I didn't say they were better. Yeah, I didn't say they were more performant.
They weren't even close until this year. And then this year, they're like knocking it out of the park with their new graphics cards. So now
with
is
their
the
new
time.
Processors, too.
Yeah, yes. Their new processors, too. Yeah.
I just want to say this. AMD is like a boxer getting into the MMA ring and still beating up on everybody. Right? Because AMD has historically always been a CPU manufacturer. They kind of got into the GPU game and did okay. But all of a sudden, they are hitting way above their weight class in both categories because Intel has been dominating, NVIDIA has been dominating, and now both of those companies are having a good run for their money because AMD is just dancing all over these companies. It's amazing, and I'm so glad that I've been Team Red for this while, right? Like, I'm a glutton for the punishment, but now I finally get rewarded for it. Yes! So excited.
Didn't AMD used to be green?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, actually, their little arrow icon used to be green. Now it's just Team Red. Everybody, jump on the Team Red boat. We are about to blast off. Last thing that we have on here is a new GPD P2 Max 8.9-inch Ultrabook. Who's buying one of these?
I wish I was buying one of these. Now,
not me.
I put in a link to the YouTube video for Linus Tech Tips, and he does a really good job covering this. And he's covered a bunch of the GPD products, and I don't know if anybody is familiar with these, but like the GPD Pocket, the GPD Win, the GPD Win 2, the GPD Pocket 2, all great little tiny handheld devices. Now, I really like the GPD Pocket 2 because it's like the size of a cell phone, but it's a full computer, and it's reviewed well. I'd love to get one. I'm not spending $500 on one. Hopefully the price comes down one day. But this new device is slightly larger at an 8.9-inch screen, and it really brings back that whole netbook feel to it. And it's got some insane stats for an 8.9-inch Ultrabook. It's got two USB 3.0 slots and a USB-C slot, and it's running the, well, the high-end one is running the M3 8100Y processor, which scores like 3,500 points on Passmark, and you can get the either 8GB or 16GB RAM version of that, and it's just a really good-looking device, and I would love to own one, but I probably never will, because by the time I can afford it, it will be old technology.
Yeah, well, I started watching the video, and about halfway through, he'd already said everything there was to say. He was just bubbling like a fanboy about the device, and there is still half the video to go. I just gave up.
Okay. Well, like I said, I liked the video, and he does talk about the trackpad not being the best, but the keyboard being really good. So it's definitely something that I would like. And it's that size kind of, you know, between a cell phone size and a laptop size. And I don't know if I would carry it around as much as I would if, say, the GPD Pocket 2, if I could get a hold of one. But it would definitely be something that I would like to get hands-on with for a while.
The older I get, the more I need a bigger keyboard and a bigger screen, and so I'm no longer a fan of this, but 10 years ago, I would have been all over this kind of device.
Yeah, just definitely. That $700 price tag kind of kills it for me.
Yeah, how much was the original EPC anyhow? I know we bought a bunch of 701s and some 901s for the homeless people in Asheville, so it couldn't have been too much.
Right. Well, I didn't have the triple EPC. I had Acer Aspire 1, and that was relatively close to launch date, but I didn't get it new, and I know I paid $270 for it.
So it's a great device, great specs, and not a great price.
Right. And I don't see the prices dropping on the older ones. I didn't see a price drop on the GPD Pocket when the GPD Pocket 2 came out. So I don't know. Maybe they just retain their value.
Maybe there's just not enough of them in the market for them to lose market value.
Right. Could be that too.
Well, a quick correction on the AMD stuff. So there is still a binary blob loaded on boot, but I'm still Team Red. I'm still feeling it. All right, let me see. Where are we at? Oh, it's security time. So let's head on to the security update.
This episode has been hacked.
No. So, security update time. So, over the past couple of weeks, Firefox has added some really cool tech. DNS over HTTPS. I've heard it on a bunch of different podcasts, and I am all on board with this, to be honest. So DNS over HTTPS, regardless of the Firefox stuff, is a way to encrypt DNS requests. And this has been something that has been so due over time, because we went from HTTP to HTTPS quite a while ago, years ago, and I mean, there were definitely the security type blue teamers that were really worried about this, because it was gonna, oh, it's gonna obfuscate everything, no one's gonna be able to see anything. And then I mentioned to Bo earlier, the Palo Alto boxes can kind of break this, but it's not easy to do. Now, DNS has finally caught up and is using TLS in the background as well. So the thing with this is, so the overall idea of this is that it's going to obfuscate your DNS requests for anywhere that you go from people like your ISP. So the same people that you would be combating with a VPN are the same people that are going to get helped by DNS over HTTPS when they cannot use a VPN. However, your threat model is still kind of weird, because you have to choose some other company to trust. Same as with a VPN, right? I mean, if you're using a VPN and you're trusting, I don't know, Private Internet Access or NordVPN or somebody like that, you're trusting them with your data. So same with DNS over HTTPS. It is obfuscated from prying eyes, but you're still trusting whatever company it is that you choose in the
endpoint.
In the options of Firefox. Yeah, your endpoint. You still have to trust that group. So, but the good thing, though, is that, like, ISPs can't hijack your DNS and do weird stuff with it. And that's really where I was concerned about DNS stuff. And it's clear text, so anybody listening on the wire can see where you're going and when you go there.
Right, right. With HTTPS, yes, your actual web page is encrypted. Everything you get from there is encrypted. But the DNS request is still unencrypted unless you're using this.
Right, exactly. So I think this is a good thing. I think everybody should use it, but I also think that you need to do some research on the company that you're going to be trusting with your DNS, right? So, I mean, just like with your ISP, they could look at your DNS logs. So, too, can any company running a DNS over HTTPS node for you. But you can run it yourself as well, which... it's still unencrypted at a certain point. Somebody has to make a typical, if you're running it yourself, you still have to make a typical DNS request, if I'm not mistaken. So we'll just see how this kind of goes. But that's the idea. You're encrypting DNS, and the ISPA over in the UK got their panties in a bunch about this and named Firefox the villain of the internet or something like that. And then they retracted that. They didn't realize how... I guess passionate internet people are about encryption. But anyway, so as a privacy hawk, I kind of think that everybody should use this, but you should look into who you're trusting. So the way that you turn this on is go into Firefox. I think every browser has the ability to do this. I think some of that might be in beta, so you'll just have to check with your own browser. I use Firefox, so I wrote it up for Firefox. So In the preferences of Firefox, go to that little three dashes menu, preferences, and then down at the bottom of the screen, you get an enable DNS over HTTPS. So by default, that's Cloudflare. I think we as a internet culture are pretty trusting of Cloudflare overall. They sit in front of a lot of websites preventing DDoS attacks. So I think we're already trusting them with a lot of the internet stuff in the first place, but I think there are a lot of DNS over HTTPS groups. So I don't have a list in front of me, but I want to say that Google runs their own, that Quad9 is running their own, OpenDNS, all those guys are probably going to end up running their own if they aren't already. But this is kind of the idea. You want to encrypt everything that you do from here on out. So my last little point on this is do not make the mistake of thinking that putting DNS over HTTPS on is going to fully anonymize you. It will not. That is not how this works. It will anonymize, or it will encrypt, not anonymize. It will encrypt your DNS requests. But if you've never been to a website that's running HTTPS before, then you have to realize that during the initial handshake where you negotiate the encryption and you download the certificate, that happens in clear text. You don't have the key yet. You don't have the certificate yet. So you cannot encrypt between you and that server. So a couple of the back and forths are still in clear text. And guess what that means? Anybody that's listening on the wire that is watching this, and there's not many people doing this, don't worry too much, but anybody that can listen on the wire can still see where you are going. So DNS over HTTPS is a great step in a great direction, but it is not the full-on anonymization thing that I've kind of heard a couple of people kind of tout it as. It does not fully protect you for, prevent you from showing people where you're going. So be careful with that. Don't take this as the end-all be-all, but it's a great step in the right direction. All right, so on the announcement side, you actually might already know this, but the show is split into two. We got a lot of feedback both ways, and I think the majority of our group decided we wanted to split this thing. So we're going to split this thing. And you got the first half
of... For this show,
we
better...
Well, yeah, I know. This particular one is, we're coming up on 3 hours if we don't stop this right now. So anyhow, the announcement is we're splitting it. So we split it. But I think that's about it, actually. So in the wrap up, let me hear where we can find all of us fine folks. Joe, where can I find more of you?
Well, you know, if you enjoy my voice, you can catch me on a couple of the other podcasts that I'm on.
I do.
That's the Linux Link Tech Show, which is at www.tllts.org.
And if you think our show is long, listen to that one.
Right. Well, the Linux Lugcast isn't short either, and that's at www.linuxlugcast.com. Or you can catch me on MeWe, or you can send me an email at jb@mintcast.org.
And then I know we're going out of order, so forgive me here. Josh, where can we find more of you?
You can find me at josh@mintcast.org, edgebox.org, and All About Code on Twitter.
All right, and now he can get the heck out of here if he needs to. And Bo, where can we find more of you?
Well, I do several podcasts. You can find all of them at undercastnetwork.com. And just to give a few examples, I'm going to invite Joe on to explain to me why Red Dwarf shouldn't die on Electric City Nerds. That's at ecnradio.com. And last night, me and my Australian co-host watched the movie Shazam together and talked during the movie and drank too much. And you can find that at filmflams.com.
Red Dwarf is awesome.
Shazam wasn't bad either.
No, it wasn't bad.
And Moss, where can we find more of you?
Oh, you know where to look for me. You just pick up the rock and you turn it over a couple times. Triad Bardic College website I've got Peaceful Hippo, which I used to actually have a fairly regular blog at, and I might get back to that. I do have a blog on DreamWidth, that's it. MeWe, my music's on Bandcamp and all over YouTube, mainly because I didn't ever collect it into my page. You can search for Moss Bliss and ignore the young black South African gospel singer. I can be emailed at moss@mintcast.org or at distrohoppersdigest@gmail.com.
And what about you, Tony Hughes?
Hello. Yes, you can find me on Hacker Public Radio on the correspondence page. I'm ID338. I do an occasional blog at tony-hughes.blogspot.com. I'm on Twitter, TonyH1212, and you can contact me on distrohoppers@gmail.com and also th@mintcast.com. .org, sorry.
And you can get it. Tony Watts in case you need him at tw@mintcast.org, and you can also listen to some of his music at Echoes of Savages on YouTube. And you can find some of me at leochavez.org. You can find me on Twitter at leochavez. And now, Full Circle Weekly News as well.
Always worth a listen, and it doesn't take much time.
It's news. It's dry. So if you want dry news, that's where you can go. Yeah, for sure. It's like Ubuntu-centric. So it actually does make sense if you listen to this show. But before we leave, we want to make sure to acknowledge some of the people who make Mintcast possible. Josh, for working on redesigning our website, setting up the YouTube stream, and providing lots and lots and lots of technical help. ByteMark Hosting for providing the new hosting server for the website. Go there, check it out, it's awesome. Archive.org for hosting our audio files. The folks at Hacker Public Radio for the mumble server we use to communicate. And the Linux Mint development team for the fine distro we love to talk about every fortnight.
Thanks, Clem.
Thanks, Clem.
This has been another episode of the Mintcast podcast. The show notes for this episode are at mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. You can find more information about Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter, @Mintcast and @Linux_Mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com for our theme music, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Mintcast.
Welcome to the Moss Show, where Moss talks about stuff for 45 minutes and doesn't really say anything.